Coming up on Path to Zero.
We really need to stay focused on innovation. It's what we need not only for our environment and, you know, global emissions, it's what we need for our economic and national security.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, and thanks for being with us. You know, if you're a regular listener, you know that I welcome all points of view here on Path to Zero. We've had guests who believe that all fossil fuels should be eliminated and as soon as possible. And we've had guests whose work spans from environmental justice to restorative agriculture to hurricane relief. We are all part of a wide path conversation in the journey towards a low carbon future. Well, in this episode, I have a guest who believes one of the keys to that successful journey is to take a conservative approach to climate change. Our guest is Drew Bond, the co-founder and president of C3 Solutions. C3 stands for Conservative Coalition for Climate Solutions. Bond served as a senior advisor for President George W. Bush at the U.S. Department of Energy. He was the chief of staff at the Heritage Foundation, and he also worked under former U.S. Senator Don Nichols from Oklahoma. Drew, it's great to have you on the Path to Zero.
Tucker, thank you so much for having me.
C3 Solutions, you founded it, I think, with John Hart. Is that correct?
That's right.
Kind of a well-known Republican. I think John Hart had a good career with Tom Coburn, if I get my history right.
That's right.
How did these conservatives, you coming out of the Bush era, him, you know, with a nice alignment with Tom Coburn, how do you go to climate change? What was driving you to see this?
Yeah, so great question. To put a sharper point on it, you know, so John worked as communications director for Tom Coburn, you know, stalwart conservative, throughout his career, House and Senate, helped him write a couple books. I, in addition to working for George W. Bush at the Department of Energy, had previously worked as chief of staff to Ed Fulmer at the Heritage Foundation, and got my first start on Capitol Hill for Don Nichols, another good Oklahoman and a physical conservative. So your question is a good one: is how in the world did a guy like that, two guys like that, get from there to here? And I'll tell you, it was a process. I think the first kind of memorable point along the way for me was when we were, you know, fighting a war in the Gulf, and I was actually in Oklahoma at the time at the Corporation Commission as chief of staff for Denise Boddy, someone who actually, you know, comes from the oil patch and represented the Independent Petroleum Association and, as a conservative in many rights herself. And so we were at that time fighting to keep small oil producers in business, because oil oil had gone from it was something less than like $20 a barrel when I was working at the Corporation Commission, to then you fast forward to, you know, early 2000, you know, late, I guess, late 2001, around then, and oil was $130 a barrel, $140, you know, on its way up to almost $150 a barrel. And I just thought, you know, that I at that point had lived long enough to see the trend of oil going up and down and up and down, and this continual cycle of being reliant on the Middle East for our oil, and just thought, this is insane. And so we've got to do something different. We need to diversify our energy sources. And so this is obviously before the fracking revolution came along. And so I got into a job at the Department of Energy working in the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy, and specifically on technology commercialization. And I knew nothing about renewable energy. But what I knew was that I loved technology and I loved innovation. And when you looked at where the world was going, when you looked at where investments were going, it was just an incredible opportunity to kind of be a part of the future. So that was just a fantastic opportunity. And then, you know, fast forward through a number of other startups and roles that I've had in and out of policy. You know, John Hart, back to my co-founder, he and I were talking one day, and he had bought a 62-acre farm in rural Maryland. He wanted to get out of D.C. and raise his kids on the farm. He's from Kansas. And I actually had helped found and still have a solar company. And never in the world did I think I would be, you know, in the solar business. Honestly, I didn't love how the panels looked, and they were expensive, and they required, you know, tax incentives. And so I just really didn't like the industry writ large. But I felt like there was something there. And when I saw this product that had been first prototyped, I thought, man, there's something really interesting. So anyway, long story short is I've also got a solar company called Powerfield Energy. So here's two conservatives, right? One that worked for Tom Coburn, and one that worked for Don Nichols and the Heritage Foundation and George W. Bush. One that, you know, just bought 62 acres of land, and the other one that had a, you know, has a solar company. And we were talking about how frustrating it is that conservatives and Republicans are constantly trying to fight with the left over whether or not climate change is real and the science. And we feel like, frankly, that much of that debate has been lost. And so where the argument really needs to move to is, well, what are we going to do about the problem? I mean, you could argue about to what extent the problem exists and to how urgent it is. And there are people all across the spectrum that say, you know, either it's not an issue, or, you know, we need to pull the alarm bells and run for the hills. And everywhere in between. And when I look at all the data and I read as much of this research as I can, you know, I take away a couple of things. One, you know, we're learning more every day. We are emitting more emissions from industrial activity and a growing world population every day. And I know that fundamentally, like, too much of any good thing is not a good thing, right? And so you can actually die of oxygen toxicity. So just trying to make the point there that, look, you know, there's a risk involved in having too much carbon in the atmosphere. And I've talked to enough scientists to know that there's a serious risk. And carbon as a molecule sticks around in the atmosphere for a very long time. So it continues to build up and build up and build up and build up. Now, you know, that there are folks that are, you know, in the skeptic camp that say, look, we live in a dynamic world and you can't control the weather. And, you know, all that's true, right? And I believe also in a God that's bigger than all of this. And so, you know, I'm not going to run for the hills on this and pull the alarm bells. But I can also say that there's a significant risk. And when you talk to farmers and when you talk to people that have been around, they see a difference in the weather patterns. They see a difference in the seasons. And they see a difference in, like, species migration and things like that. So all that to say is, you know, we said, look, climate change is real, and people are all over the map on where they are on that. But what's more important is, what are we going to do about it? So John and I started this organization called the Conservative Coalition for Climate Solutions. And we go by C3 Solutions, but intentionally put Conservative, Coalition, and Climate, and Solutions in our name, because we believe climate change is real. We are conservative. We think we have to work in coalitions and build coalitions and fundamentally focus on solutions. And it's the kind of solutions that, you know, we've talked about all across the board: technology, innovation, and finding ways of oftentimes getting, you know, the government out of the way. But so early 2020, we started this organization. We're a 501c3, you know, not-for-profit educational organization. We're kind of a three-legged stool, if you want to think about it like that. So we do policy. So we help identify policies, analyze policies, and educate, you know, policymakers. And then we work in coalitions with others. So we work a lot across the aisle, but I'll say specifically on the right. So with Heritage Foundation, with, you know, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, other groups that are kind of, you know, across the board, industry groups like yourselves. Try not to be, you know, dogmatic and very practical, but given that we come from this from a very, you know, free market perspective, then we don't hide our conservative credentials. And so that's, you know, policy, coalitions, and then communications. and meaning you know you got to get your message out. If you're selling ideas, you've got to market them. And that was one thing that I learned, you know, at Heritage well. And so as a part of that, we actually have an online news magazine called c3newsmag.com, or we just call it C3. And there we aggregate content from across the web, and just point back to wherever it came from, and then put kind of a 3-bullet-point summary at the end of each article, trying to help people see that free markets and innovation and the free enterprise system and, you know, companies, like, there's a lot of activity going on right now to solve or to address climate change. And so, you know, let's not get depressed and to thinking that nothing is being done about climate change and only if the government would step in. There's actually a lot of activity going on, a lot of investment happening. And so then we also write, you know, articles and op-eds from others. And anyway, I could go on and on. We've got an incredible advisory board with some very notable folks. So I would just say I'd love it if, you know, your folks would take a look at our news magazine and sign up for our newsletter.
I already made a note about that. So you consistently talk about innovation. You consistently talk about market solutions. But governments seem to just continually want to intervene. You yourself are coming from government with George Bush 43, and then certainly DOE before that. Here we are going into Glasgow, COP26. We're going to hear from China. We're going to hear from Europe. We're going to hear about how governments need to solve this problem. What is the role of government? Let's just think internationally for a moment, in providing the backdrop for innovation.
Yeah, I think there's an important role for government in that what government can do best is what it should do best, which is invest where industry can't. So government can and should invest in energy innovation. It should invest in research and development, right? We have an incredible, you know, Department of Energy, U.S. National Lab System here in the United States. We've got like 17 national labs across the country working on incredible things. And, you know, most people don't even know that they exist unless they have one in their backyard. But these are, you know, the major leagues of scientists and working every day on the hardest problems of the world. And so, you know, the first thing that governments can do is invest. And so, you know, we at C3 Solutions have, you know, said, look, you've got to invest in energy innovation or you're not going to get the kind of innovation that you need. Because we need to attract the world's best scientists here. And, you know, the fracking revolution is a good example of this, is where, look, it wasn't a lot of money, but, you know, it was a fair amount of money spread out over a number of years that the Department of Energy did to invest in fracking technology at a time when it didn't make economic sense to do that. But thankfully, you know, they did, so that when the market was ripe and the innovators and entrepreneurs were there, it took off. So I think, you know, there's those types of examples where it just makes sense for, you know, countries to invest in themselves and to invest in their future for, you know, for things like energy innovation.
And can I add one thing? And perhaps sometimes and I think I find this myself, sometimes to stay out of the way and let private enterprise drive to the finish line. I mean, one of the things I find so frustrating in this current debate around 1.2 trillion or 3.5 trillion is that so much of this private industry could get to, and it would leave the government to actually do things that government has to do, right? True infrastructure, true societal needs, education, policing, housing, however you want to label that. But I find sometimes they want to be so involved, they almost confound private investment and sometimes hamper innovation.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think in some ways that is true, or certainly can be true, right? I mean, the government can step in and get in the way, and they do it all the time. They do it with regulations. They often do it with tax credits, frankly. I mean, a lot of tax credits are, you know, they go to benefit you know, investment banks and large investors more than they actually help, you know, the little guy. And so those are areas where, you know, we would say, look, we would love to see a tax system that truly is a level playing field where there's no tax incentives. There's no, meaning there's no tax credits, right? I mean, the incentive is there with the market. And so, you know, with the government trying to pull the levers on, you know, tax credits for this technology or tax credits for that technology, it distorts the market. And I can tell you that as a, you know, CEO of a solar company. I mean, if you try to go develop a solar project, you're going to run into essentially three big hurdles. One is you've got to site the project, right? You got to find the land, you got to secure it up. That's hurdle number one. Number two is you got to corral the capital to build the project, right? And there's, and then there's some, you know, significant permitting and the process and that. And number three is you got to go secure financing for the tax credits. So the tax credits have completely distorted that market. And it's not unique for solar. It's, you know, I would argue across the board. And so, we, you know, I think to your point about government barriers, we think about government barriers as you know, things like the you know, the NEPA, you know, law, which is, you know, the National Environmental Performance Act, Protection Act, you know, that's like 50 years old. This law is there and supposed to protect the environment. But in many cases, it gets in the way of actually deploying cleaner energy technologies that are good for the environment. So, yeah, you know, so you want to deploy a solar farm, you're probably going to run into NEPA if you're doing a big one. If you want to deploy nuclear energy faster, well, you're going to be, you know, you're going to be deep in the weeds on NEPA for probably 10 years. So there's those types of barriers. But then to your point about, you know, where does the government invest and not invest? You know, I think that's an area where there's some gray area, in that, you know, when you are looking to invest a first of a kind technology, let's take a small modular nuclear reactor, for instance, right? There are investors who are willing to invest in that, but they want to invest in not the first of a kind and maybe not the second of a kind, right, but probably the third of a kind. And so, you know, that is an area where the government, you know, I think can take on some shared risk with the private sector. And so, you know, as I think about it, it's essentially, you know, the earlier the stage, the research, you know, that should be almost 100% funded. As the research gets closer to the market, then there needs to be more cost sharing from the private sector. And, you know, honestly, I would love it if the government didn't have to invest a dime in R&D. But the reality is companies are not doing it because they're driven by their quarterly reports and to shareholders. And when you have to report every quarter on your investments for investments that can take 10 years to pay off, then there's just no appetite there for that. I mean, we talked to, in one of my previous roles, you know, we spent some time talking to the glass manufacturing industry, and you know, they just don't, they are such under such competitive pressure internationally, with, you know, all the labor, you know, incompatibilities, I'll call them, here versus some of the other countries. And so trying to stay lean and mean and competitive, fundamentally means that they don't have the money nor the time to invest in innovation without having some kind of a public-private partnership. So I feel like there's a role there to play, but my, you know, the big challenge is when you hear about climate change and it being a global issue, I mean, back to your, you know, earliest question about, you know, COP and, well, what should governments do? I absolutely agree that they ought to find ways to get out of the way of innovation, as opposed to, you know, it feels like you've got a bunch of politicians just trying to get in front of the parade, frankly, and they're making commitments that no one is living up to. Yes. And so, you know, it's sort of like, you know, one country's trying to one up the other country. And in the meantime, I mean, even China's out there saying they're going to meet, you know, such and such carbon goals by whatever date, it seems to change. But they're not even doing anything right now to do it, other than, you know, they're growing their economy enormously on with coal.
Right. It's interesting to watch. I think as I was preparing myself for COP26, started looking at the promises made, you know, really from the first Paris Accord, and seeing if anyone had even made any attempt to achieve what they promised in Paris. And I really find very few examples where anyone is even close to it. And frankly, the measurements, you know, we all say, unless you measure it, you probably can't achieve it. I find very few people are really even willing to talk about their measurements. Well, I want to keep going, because you look, I could talk about a lot of articles that you and John Hart wrote. But you've talked here about immediacy and now, and I know one of the writings I followed, you said this: conservatives have the opportunity to offer effective, meaningful, and fiscally responsible policies that can be enacted right now to mitigate climate change. I mean, I'm always fascinated. One of the things that we talk about so often is probably every climate scientist tends to think that right now is important, right? I mean, we need to be doing things right now. And yet so much of what I see is not only it's decades away, right? So I actually wrote an article about this, emphasizing it, called Today, Today, Today. I would argue that low carbon technologies like propane, like natural gas, can be utilized more, should be utilized more right now, because in almost every example I see, their carbon intensities are lower than the current carbon intensities of other things, certainly diesel fuel, certainly gasoline, certainly the electric grid, I would argue, in about 40 of the 50 states. What are your thoughts about how lower carbon energy sources like propane, like natural gas, fit into these solutions?
Yeah, I think they fit very well. And, you know, again, you guys have, I mean, the natural gas industry and, you know, propane has just an incredible track record already of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and, you know, doing it, you know, responsibly. So when we think about the now, we certainly think about natural gas and propane. We certainly think about, you know, what are those existing technologies that we already have today? And, you know, the fracking revolution, while it unlocked, you know, the American and the global, you know, potential for reducing greenhouse gas emissions faster than any other technology, it also started, you know, because there was such a, you know, a glut of gas on the market, that created its own market challenges, as you know. And so, and in addition to the market challenge, the environmental challenges, I think there's still this group out there that on the extreme environmental left, that there is no technology that is fossil related that will ever be accepted to them, period. And so they see natural gas as like some kind of a, you know, gateway drug to fossil fuel use into eternity. Where I think you and I would look at it and say, look, if you're trying to reduce greenhouse gas emissions as fast as possible, we've got this resource here right now. Why don't we use it as much as we can while we innovate for the future? And so it's a way for us to ramp down our emissions dramatically and also help fuel, you know, the world in many cases. I mean, we're now exporting natural gas, which is just amazing to me that you can do that. But I hopefully that answers your question. You know, I mean, I and then, you know, you look at, you know, nuclear energy, you know, we've got something like, I don't know, 80 nuclear reactors around the country right now. There was not long ago, we had about 100 of them. And so we've started to shut those down. That's concerning, because that is clean electricity. And so there just seems to be a misalignment sometimes of, like, you know, trying to make the perfect the enemy of the good. And in this case, you know, natural gas and propane and some of those existing technologies that are considered and are fossil fuels, right, are good. They're good. They're highly energy, intensive in terms of, like, you know, you get a lot of bang for your buck, right, for that molecule. And especially compared to, I love renewables, but, you know, solar and wind have a lot of inefficiencies in the generation process. So anyway, I could go on, but hopefully that answers your question.
Drew, it's time for a break, and then we'll continue this great conversation right after this.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a future of zero emissions starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low-carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane, Clean American Energy. Learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us.
Welcome back. Our guest is Drew Bond, the CEO of C3 Solutions. So a couple times you have talked about nuclear power. I know from preparing for this today, you're an advocate for nuclear power. And I would say anybody who really has a broad field of view and thinks about energy has to advocate for clean power and nuclear power, because when we think about clean and density, it is the epitome of perfect, right? So I think, and I know, you know, Bill Gates, you talked about small scale modular. Bill Gates is certainly a earlier stage investor in Wyoming.
Yeah.
Do you think, I mean, couple of things strike me about nuclear power. Doesn't seem to have a fan base anywhere other than in wonky science like you and I, perhaps. Those solutions are 10 or 20 or 30 years out. Do you think, as I look to the grid, I'm always thinking about what does this grid look like in 20, 40, and 50? Because that's really where it matters, right? I see hydroelectric probably not increasing. Certainly traditional hydropower, not where we dam rivers, dam lakes. Maybe we'll have pump storage or some other unique things for hydro, but hydro's gone away. I don't know. I mean, does nuclear have a future? I know it technically makes sense, but we think about policy and the environment and financing. Can you see a future for nuclear?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I see actually a really good future for nuclear, but you know, as you know, you know, it's like not everybody's raising their hand because they want a nuclear power plant in their backyard. You know, there's where I see, you know, so much hope in this regard is the fact that, you know, there's something like 80 companies in the United States right now that are all working on nuclear energy in some, you know, form or fashion. But more than that, you know, some of those are big companies, but there's also a lot of small companies and startup companies that are working on these small modular reactors. And so, you know, and small sometimes means, you know, it could be a mini reactor like a shipping container size system, or it could be, you know, the size of, I don't know, a small commercial building, and that, you know, these reactors can be kind of co-located so that they can, you know, generate utility scale, you know, power. So it really kind of depends on the technology. It's sometimes a megawatt and sometimes, you know, 100 megawatts, but so, you know, whether it's powering 600 homes or 6,000 homes, I think the amount of innovations going on, you mentioned Bill Gates. I mean, when somebody like that invests as much money as he has invested in TerraPower, you know, there's, I think it's obviously going to create, you know, a lot of innovation in that space. And you know, I was just talking to the head of the U.S. Nuclear Industry Council the other day, and obviously he's an advocate for it. But you know, when I hear him talk about the amount of companies that are involved in this, I think there's a there. But you know, two other things. I mean, one is on the small modular reactors. I mean, these are being designed to be essentially fail safe. So imagine a shipping container, right? You know, 18-wheeler trailer. Imagine that being a nuclear reactor, and imagine digging a hole and putting it in the ground and covering it up and farming on top of it. And imagine that if for some reason there was something that happened that failed in the system shuts down. It doesn't get hotter, it simply gets cooler and shuts down. I mean, that's the kind of technology that's being developed. And there's a company called Oklo that's doing this. which actually has some Oklahoma roots and has gotten a lot of investment from Silicon Valley. You know, there's a company called X Energy. Clay Sell is the deputy secretary, was the deputy secretary of energy when I was at DOE. Clay is the CEO of that company, and you know, they're building various scales of those types of reactors and the fuel associated with it. So they've got not just the hardware, but also the fuel, which is critical. So, but you know, to your point, like who's going to raise their hand and put this in their backyard? I think that's why as it gets smaller, it gets easier to place and permit. But you know, the government's going to have to find ways of getting out of the way in some ways on this. I mean, we obviously need a strong regulatory structure to ensure that that nuclear system, that nuclear fuel, is stays where it is and doesn't go anywhere and is safe, right? But you know, when you look at developing a nuclear power plant and it takes 10 years and seven of it is because of these, you know, NEPA regulations, right? Like that's a problem.
I'm really glad to hear. I know you're much more learned about that, and I probably have looked at 50 or 60 studies where you match consumption and growth rates for demand, and then you think about the sources we have: natural gas, nuclear, hydro, solar, wind. I mean, the sources aren't, it's not a long list. They always seem to have a fudge factor. Sometimes it's conservation, sometimes it's technology, but nuclear seems to be, at the end of the day, the only true answer that combines scale and clean and density.
Yeah.
So it's good. I'm glad to hear you say that. All right. So let's start wrapping up. But in the wrap up is always sometimes the best part because we get to have a little fun. The first thing we do is we're going to hand you a magic wand. And this is a powerful wand. You get to change one thing, just one thing, in the next year regarding the climate conversation. So, Drew, how would you use your magic wand to change one thing you'd like to see done differently that will dramatically improve our ability to move towards a cleaner climate?
So can this be a technology or does it need to be a policy?
We never limit you how you only get to use it one time, but you are without limits as long as you choose one.
All right. Well, I mean, if I had a magic wand, I mean, I don't want to be such a proponent for nuclear because I love natural gas. I love, you know, all the forms of energy that are, you know, that are innovating. But, you know, I would say, you know, I'd use that wand for fusion. You know, fusion is one of those technologies in the energy, you know, nuclear space that has always been 5 years away. And the joke is it always will. But, you know, it every time I talk to a scientist lately, you know, it seems to be kind of back up on the priority list in terms of some breakthroughs that are happening. And so, you know, fusion, you know, is basically what the sun does, right? It's a fusion reactor. And so if we could design small fusion reactors that power, you know, large cities and countries, I mean, that would just be an incredible magic wand. So I'll take that.
Yeah. And by the way, I agree. In fact, I read quite a bit this week on fusion, and I see it every day in my own work, that things that even a decade ago we couldn't do, now, as I quickly say, the marriage of science with technology and engineering and manufacturing, we're able to do things that we couldn't do just 4 or 5 years ago. I certainly tend to hope that fusion, which has been the holy grail of energy for quite some time, I believe we are right on the door of that. So that's awesome. Yeah. Okay. Look, this is the second part that we do that is so fun, which is to say, first off, thank you. Thank you for sharing your expertise and kind of all the wisdom you have. And you've been a great guest. And we want to thank you for being a great guest. We do it with a virtual gift. When we started the Path to Zero, we talked about the virtual national forest. And everywhere we go, we plant a tree in our guest's honor. Now, our team really finds you to be deeply rooted in Oklahoma. So they want to talk about Oklahoma properties. They want to talk about great forests like the, I think you call it Washita. Is that how you say that?
Yeah.
Washita.
Okay. Yeah. So the Washita National Forest, which I actually have been there. I just wanted to pronounce it, in eastern Oklahoma. I'm also aware, though, that you are a Virginian. And so we should include some great part of the Allegheny National Forest or the George Washington Forest or the Blue Ridge. But Would you be kind enough to share with us a place you would love to see a tree planted in your name and in your honor?
Oh, man. Yeah, thank you. It's very kind of you. That would be kind of fun to take my kids and go look at a tree that has been planted and
grown. Absolutely.
So, I have to say I'm honored that you would think about the Ouachita National Forest. And so that sounds like a really fun field trip. But as you mentioned, I live in Virginia, and I'm more often out in the Shenandoah area. So I'd love to see something there.
Well, we can easily do that. And I would be honored sometime to take you to that spot and show you and your family where that tree is in the Shenandoah National Forest, because it is certainly a beautiful place.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you. Well, then hopefully I'll get to the Ouachita National Forest and plant my own tree anyway. But I don't suppose I could pick the National Mall. Could I put my tree there?
I don't think we can plant it, but I will tell you a little known secret about the National Mall. That grass on the National Mall is cut with mowers that are low carbon, fueled by propane.
Oh, so, I love that.
Yeah, it's a great story. All right, so let's see. Before we let you go, our listeners, I know, are going to be really interested in learning more about you. Anything you want to tell them about something you're doing or something that we haven't talked about? Any kind of parting shots for our listeners?
Yeah, I guess I would say, again, please check us out at c3newsmag.com. That's our news magazine where we're really trying to elevate, what free market solutions are doing to address all things energy and the environment. And there you might find reference to, in fact, there is highlighted there, what one of the key kind of policy efforts that we have underway right now, which is, we wrote this paper called Free Economies Are Clean Economies. And so we did something interesting there where we took two different indices. So the Heritage Foundation has an index of economic freedom that they've done for almost 30 years. And Yale University has an environmental performance index. And when you put the data together, what you see is that as economies, again, we're thinking countries here, right? So as economies become freer, they also become cleaner. So that's a message that we fundamentally believe in and think should really be the foundation of policymakers as they think about addressing climate change. It goes back to the conversations we've had about how do you reduce government barriers. So we're going to be over at the, the UN COP meeting, the Conference of Parties meeting in November in Scotland, actually presenting this paper and promoting it. And then we've got an ongoing effort to really help educate people on what free markets can do for the environment. And your industry knows this well, right? The propane industry knows this well. It's like when given the opportunity to start a business and grow that business, you can do incredible things, not only for your family and the world economically, but also environmentally. So I would just encourage your listeners to please check that out.
That is awesome. C3newsmag.com.
Yes.
Drew, you have been a terrific guest. Thank you so much for your time and for your expertise and for being with us today.
Thank you, Tucker.
Well, I really enjoyed that conversation with Drew Bond, and I hope you did as well. In saying that, it's time for listener mail. This week's question comes from another great Oklahoman named CJ. I've actually known CJ and his family for many years, so I was thrilled to get his email. Here's his question. Tucker, beef production contributes to global warming because of the methane cattle release. So that's a climate change problem. But at the same time, one of the main ingredients for the making of renewable propane is animal fats that come from cattle. If animal fats are renewable propane feedstock, can we say that renewable propane is indeed a good solution? Well, thanks for that question, CJ. I love getting it because you're thinking through some of the complexity associated with climate change. I've said for years that energy is not binary, either all good or bad. There isn't a perfect energy, not even solar or wind. So when it comes to renewable propane, the same holds true. It's not perfect, but I have good news. It's getting better every day. Today, producers like REG Energy are making renewable propane from waste vegetable oils and plants as well, products that otherwise would find their way into a landfill. renewable propane is opening up the path to net zero even wider as it's being blended with, for example, dimethyl ether to create a propane that is virtually carbon free. Innovation is one of the best, but often the least talked about inside the climate change debate. And I'm really happy that renewable propane is one of those great stories today and getting better every day. That was a great question, CJ. Thanks for sending it. And if you want to send me a note to comment on an episode or to give me something new to consider, I'd love to hear from you. Just shoot me an email. The address is path to zero. That's path, the word to, T-O, path to zero at propane.com. Thank you for listening. And I look forward to talking with another guest very soon as we travel the path to zero.
This has been Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. Subscribe and learn more at cleanamericanenergy.us. And if you like what you have heard, rate us on whatever platform you use to listen to your podcasts.